You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Reading is from Rumi. Those who don't feel this love pulling them like a river, those who don't drink dawn like a cup of spring water, or take in the sunset like supper, those who don't want to change, let them sleep on. This love is beyond the study of theology, that old trickery and hypocrisy. If you want to improve your mind that way, sleep on. I've given up on my brain. I've torn the cloth to shreds and thrown it away. If you're not completely naked, wrap your beautiful robe of words around you and sleep on.
We're not here to sleep, although for the next 20 minutes, I'll excuse you if you do feel like you need to. Well, one of the talents of ministers is not only to see the water, but to interpret the shimmering and reflections on the water. So here are my reflections on the water. Because water is so fundamental to life, on this blue boat that we sail on, there has always been fascination about water and mythology about water. But speaking first about some scientific facts, the Earth's surface is made up of over 70% water. As the author Arthur C. Clarke said, how inappropriate to call this planet Earth when it is quite clearly ocean. Yeah. Our brains are made up of 73% water. Even our bones are over 30% water. We have this illusion of being solid. Perhaps we need to rewrite Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. Instead of you are dust and to dust you shall return, it should probably be you are water and to water you shall return. Water is the sine qua non of life, meaning that without it we're stuffed. We all appreciate the sounds of waves lapping on the shore or waters babbling in a creek. Although it's not proven, it is easy to believe we are genetically wired to be attracted to sources of water since they indisputably sustain life. The big Kaurna campsites are always around water. For example, around the Torrens, Corowirrupurri, and the Warraparinga down near Marion. Water was not only a drinking source, but of course it attracted food sources like kangaroo and emu and other little animals. Unsurprisingly, water also features in various accounts of creation around the world as people try to understand where did we come from. In the Jewish account of creation, for example, it all started as water, not empty space. This seemed to be drawn from the Babylonian creation narrative called the Enuma Elish. I find it fascinating that Genesis chapter 1, verses 6 to 8, I'll just read it. Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky. So you see what's happening there. Now, I've translated the Hebrew rakia as expanse rather than firmament or vault, which later translations made it sound more solid. But the Jewish author was just saying that there was a space created between the water that we know on Earth and the waters of the rest of the universe. And curiously, we never hear any more in the Jewish or Christian scriptures about what happened to all that water that was left above the sky. There's all this liquid floating around up there. Perhaps that's why we call it the Milky Way. So, the creation mythology tells us that the heavens are created by lifting the primeval Venetian blinds to create a space in between. And then comes the earth, the animals, the humans, and that's when the trouble begins. But water's not just for drinking, it's for cleaning ourselves as well. That notion of purifying. And one of the most powerful metaphors in history has been the parallel between physical cleansing on the one hand and the cleansing of spiritual impurities on the other hand. We can go back to pre-Christian Jewish times and their ritual bathing. The book of Leviticus sets out numerous rules relating to being clean and unclean in the taboo sense. Both men and women were required to bathe after certain bodily emissions, not the same ones, but I'm not going to go into details about that. Bathing meant full immersion, so that all of the hair was beneath the surface of the water. The mikvah, as it's called, was usually built with steps going down to a level deep enough for a person to stand in it. And the ritual bathing would also be undertaken prior to special occasions, such as marriage or ceremonies of religious significance. And for some modern Jews, the practice has been expanded to include other celebrations, for example, after getting divorced. Those of Christian heritage learn of a variation to the Jewish ritual bathing in the stories of John the Baptist, Yochanan ben Zechariah, immersing disciples in the Jordan River. It's not that John made up a new ritual. I think he was following Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 25, for example. I shall splash pure water on you, and you shall be purified. So that goes back a long way. The sensations of being immersed in water and being summoned out of the water is a fitting metaphor for spiritual initiation, a personal transformation signifying the dissolution or absolution of the errors and injuries of the past, coupled with a wholehearted commitment to maintaining freedom in the future. Of course, baptism, like any other initiation experience, doesn't do the work for you. It signifies that the work has been done. You don't put a picture of Paris on your wall and say, "Now I've been to Paris." But if you go to Paris, you make that effort, you see those sights, then by all means you might take a picture to bring back and have as a symbol of what you have experienced. I think it's the same with our advancement as human beings. Some people will wear something around their neck or have a particular type of clothing to signify that they're a member of a tribe or that they've achieved a certain level of goodness, a certain initiation, we could say. But in fact, it means nothing unless the work has been done. And the work will be proven through the fruits of wisdom and kindness of that person. That's how we can tell if a person has done the work or not. Now we'll have a further interlude, which I understand requires a little bit of setting up. Perhaps I could just mention that last Wednesday we had a lovely session of Words of Spirit It's always enriching for the people who attend. Might be something you want to try sometime. When we read a few special words and contemplate them, their meaning and how they might benefit us. It's a lovely contemplative time. So we do that at 5:30 on the third Wednesday of the month, and meditation on the first Wednesday of the month at 5:30 on Wednesdays. Did you know that Friday, 2 days ago, was World Water Day? Since 1993, the UN has declared the 22nd of March to be World Water Day, and the theme for World Water Day 2024 is Water for Peace. About half of the world's population experiences severe water scarcity for at least part of the year. And climate change is likely to make this worse. Unfortunately, water scarcity and conflict often go together. More than a third of the world's population relies on a water source coming from beyond their borders. So you can see the potential for conflict if the neighbouring country upstream decides to put a dam in to keep that river's water for themselves. UNICEF, the UN Children's Organisation, say that on average, children under the age of 15 in war zones are nearly three times more likely to die from diseases linked to unsafe water and lack of sanitation than from direct violence. So that impact on water infrastructure is critical. Another statistic: over a quarter of the world's population lives without safely managed drinking water. In other words, they don't have in place the safeguards against pollution and the technology we use with our reservoirs and water piping system to ensure that the bugs are killed off and that it's otherwise safe to drink. Let's consider a case study. And I've referred to the Gaza Strip before. Prior to the outbreak of war in October last year, the population was about 2.3 million, about 20% more than Adelaide. There are different ways you could compare the size of the Gaza Strip to Adelaide. So today I've shown a map, which basically runs from O'Halloran Hill up to Salisbury in a more or less rectangular shape. And that shows the size of Gaza Strip compared to Adelaide. Now, due to the bombing and incursion of Israeli ground forces, evacuations have led to about three quarters of that population trying to stay alive in the Rafah area. So on the map that I've shown, Rafah is right down on the southwestern corner. Perhaps you can see that next to the Egyptian border there, and most of the Gaza Strip now occupied by Israeli forces. So that 1.7 million or so are in perhaps about a quarter of the land previously available. If you were looking at it in Adelaide terms, you could probably say it's the equivalent of the entire population of Adelaide, but living between Crossroads and O'Halloran Hill. And then you think, well, with most of the residential buildings damaged, you get an idea of the situation. There are about a million people currently living in tents, particularly on the beachfront, and there are some open areas next to the beach. So obviously the blue area on the map is the Mediterranean Sea. You may have heard recently about a ship coming in with some supplies and airdrops with boxes full of food and water, but these are not anywhere near enough necessary amount for the population to live. The only way to really get in enough food and water for the people is through the land crossings. Only trucks can really bring in enough. So there are obviously crossing points with Israel, but they're blocked, and even the Egyptian border is subject to Israeli military control, so that there are limits to what comes in at the Rafah and Kerem Shalom crossing down in the southwest. You might imagine that the water infrastructure, which sustained the population of the Gaza Strip for decades, would still be available. But on the contrary, water infrastructure has been targeted along with electricity, infrastructure, schools and hospitals. So desalination plants have been bombed, 40 water wells have been demolished, 9 constructed reservoirs have been demolished or rendered incapable of providing water, and 42 kilometres of water pipelines at last count. You may be curious about the photographs on the right-hand side of the screen. So there are these, it's such a dry area, and there are no rivers or streams that the Gaza Strip has by itself, no natural water sources effectively above ground. But they have these huge cement water capturing, rainwater capturing structures. And so you can see one that's intact and a later photograph of that one demolished. There is one desalination plant still operating in Rafah, but it's now catering for 5 times as many people as it did in peacetime. Now you might think, well, why did those people choose to live there if there aren't any natural streams or lakes? But a lot of the population are descendants of those who fled from what is now Israel in the 1948 war. So that was when they spread to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and towards Egypt, some ended up in the Gaza Strip. So after 5 months of war, the food and water shortage is leading to malnutrition and diseases associated with lack of sanitation. Many mothers don't have sufficient water to drink enough to be able to breastfeed. The numbers of children who have literally died from malnutrition and dehydration is currently less than 30, but the number is expected to increase rapidly in the short term. As Catherine Russell, UNICEF Executive Director, said, the speed at which this catastrophic child malnutrition crisis in Gaza has unfolded is shocking, especially when desperately needed assistance has been at the ready just a few miles away. Now, let us translate that to our own experience in some way. I'm sure you've all felt thirsty at some time, on a long car trip or after a long walk. But we are so blessed here. We don't have to wait long to get a drink, generally speaking. And when you're thirsty, that physical urge, you first become conscious of it, that you're thirsty, and then you think about it more and more. As your tongue sticks to the roof of your mouth and you try and lick your lips because they become so dry. And then that thirst starts preoccupying your mind and your conversation. Now I wonder if you remember that reading that Grant gave earlier from Rumi, talking about a love, Rumi thinking about love of God, whatever that meant to him, being like a powerful force that attracts us, something that we might thirst for. Rumi also wrote, if in thirst you drink water from a cup, you see God in it. Those who are not in love with God will only see their own faces in it. Now, I realise that we might have to translate that into our own spiritual perspective or humanist perspective. But it does say something to us that if we are to become wiser, kinder, more loving people, we need to have a thirst for it. It doesn't just naturally evolve. We can accentuate that process of becoming better people by being thirsty for it, wanting to extend ourselves to become wiser, kinder, and more loving. It is written in the Christian scripture that Yeshua said, if anyone is thirsty, let them come to me and drink. Now, if he did say such a thing, which is quite possible, I would respectfully suggest he wasn't after a fan club saying, come to me and drink. He was saying, come and listen to this message. And his fundamental message was to treat others as you would wish to be treated. So that's a very good start. I ask you to pause with me for a moment and to contemplate these words and to pray, if you will. As if washed away by water, let us right now allow our anxieties to be dissolved. Let us right now allow any sense of self-blaming to be dissolved, for we can forgive ourselves. Let us be so mindful of the welfare of others, as well as our own, that we thirst to become wiser and more loving and more kind. May it be so. May it be so. May it be so. We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.